Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Blaine Harden, who is out with a brand new nonfiction work. It is called Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacies of Lies, and the Taking of the American West. The book is available now wherever you buy your books, whatever platform. Blaine's a contributor to various television shows that he previously served with the Washington Post as a bureau chief in East Asia. Blaine, this story, I guess the old cliche is that history is written by the winners, and this book that you've put together is a further testament to that in these strange times. I have to admit, though, before I read this book, before it came onto my list, I had never heard of this story of Marcus Whitman. So can you kind of set up for us what the narrative was? Because I know it happened right in the neck of the woods where you grew up.
Okay. This happened in the Pacific Northwest. It's about some missionaries who came out from central New York in 1836. In fact, they were the first missionaries to come as a married couple across the Rockies. And so they were real early settlers. And they were given permission by the Cayuse tribe, which is a small tribe along the near the Columbia River in eastern Washington and eastern Oregon, to settle there. So they came in 1836, and the Cayuse accepted them because they thought that the white man's God would give them an edge, just as horses and guns had helped them to sort of enter the modern era in the early 1800s. And so that's why they brought them there. So these were the Calvinist Protestants who stayed for 11 years on the mission, the Whitman mission, as it became known. But in the end, the white man's God didn't do anything for the Cayuse Indians as they saw it. In fact, it only seemed to bring more white people out to take their land, and also that brought white people's diseases. And around 1847, a really bad measles epidemic hit the Cayuse and killed about half of them. They had a tradition in their tribe of killing medicine men who failed. And Marcus Whitman, besides being a missionary, was a medical doctor. And he tried to treat measles by bleeding people. It didn't work very well. And so the Indians died. They invoked their tradition, and they killed the Whitmans along with 11 other white people. Now, this is the sort of famous Whitman massacre. And it was an historically important tipping point in American history, because the killing motivated the U.S. Congress to declare that the Oregon country, which up until then had been held jointly with the British, was part of the United States, the Oregon Territory, and soon it became the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And so that's the factual part of the story. But there's another part which is really the focus of my book, which is a big lie about who Marcus Whitman was. And this lie was made up about 20 years after he was killed, and it was made up by another missionary, the Reverend Henry Spaulding, who was almost killed by the Cayuse tribe in 1847. Anyhow, the lie that he made up was that before Whitman was killed, he had gotten on his horse in the winter of 1842, ridden to the White House in Washington, D.C., and persuaded the president at the time, who was President Tyler, that the British were somehow scheming to steal the Pacific Northwest away from America. And he succeeded in persuading the U.S. government to send more settlers out. And in fact, the story claimed that Whitman saved Oregon. And then he was later killed by the British and the Catholics' plot. It's all ridiculous, but what's so strange about Whitman's lie, about the lie about Whitman, is that it became the official history of the United States. Congress reprinted it in 1871, and it appeared in virtually every high school textbook in the United States for more than 30 years. It was in the Encyclopedia Britannica, in the New York Times. And this was the story of how the West was won for a long time in American history.
Had the true story, the one that you've uncovered now, been reported at the time, what difference would it have made in U.S. history going forward, do you think?
Well, Whitman and his wife Narcissa would have been acknowledged as failed missionaries who whose death triggered the an act of Congress to make the Pacific Northwest a U.S. territory, and that would have been it. But as it turned out, the lie turned Whitman into a very noteworthy figure, at least for a time in American history. In 1900, New York University did a poll of the most noteworthy Americans, and Whitman was very high on the list. In fact, he ranked above Meriwether Lewis of the Lewis and Clark expedition and Sam Houston of Texas. And so this lie really, really registered in the American consciousness. And part of it was that it was a perfect propagandist lie. It was Christian. It invoked a manifest destiny. It demonized the other, which was at that time Indians. And also there was a flood of Catholic immigrants into the United States from Germany and other parts in Europe, which had sort of freaked out a lot of Protestants. So this story was a propagandist victory for that kind of demonization.
When this lie starts and it becomes part of the American lexicon, are the Indians just not in a position to counter it, or did they care, or did they know? Were they reading the same textbooks and the same histories?
Well, they learned about it. They after the Whitmans were killed in 1847, five Cayuse were arrested. They were sort of like, you round up the usual suspects. It's not even clear that all of the five were involved in this killing. But in any case, they were tried for murder in Oregon City near Portland, near present-day Portland. And this is the first full-scale murder trial in Pacific Northwest history. It was a very big deal, and very careful records were kept of it. And even some of the Cayuse tribe attended the trial. So they knew that bad things were coming. They, of course, did not know that Whitman had saved Oregon, because he hadn't. But 20 years later, when this lie started to gain currency around the country and in the Pacific Northwest, the nature of what they had done had actually changed. Instead of just killing a mediocre missionary who'd brought them measles, they'd killed a great American hero. And they were then demonized even further and more isolated. So for the next 150 years, the Cayuse tribe, which was isolated on the Umatilla Reservation with two other tribes, they were victimized. Their land was stolen. They were described as the miserable Cayuse fiends who killed the noble Whitmans. And they sort of limped through those decades, poor, isolated, demonized. And a lot of them left the reservation, and the tribe, quite honestly, almost went extinct.
I am chatting with Blaine Hardin about his brand new book, Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies, and the Taking of the American West. The book's available now. Blaine, I'm interested in the subtitle of the book, because it's a longer one that it doesn't just rattle off the tongue. I have to read it as I repeat it here. But it seems like whenever I see a nonfiction book, and this one is no different, the subtitle seems to just capture every theme so well and so succinctly. So as you went through the book and the publishers or editors or whoever came up with the subtitle did this, what's the process like to find out that you have the least amount of words possible, but you still have to tell the story just so people know what the book's about?
It's very difficult to do, particularly for the author, because I have a couple hundred thousand words swimming around in my head by the time the book is done, and all this information. And this title took months to agree on, and a number of people at Viking, the Penguin, contributed to it. It was a group effort, and I think this one really does sum up the book. One of the things that I learned from doing this book is that there is a real appetite in the American public for simple, action-packed stories that seem ordained by Almighty God, that explain the American experience. And I think we have just lived through an era, the past 4 years, where simple, clear stories that are often false help many people to understand what's going on in their lives. And the Whitman story, I think, is a great example of a false story that that won widespread acceptance and that was too perfect, actually, to surrender. What's interesting about the Whitman story, it was debunked in 1900 by a professor at Yale named Gaylord Bourne, who said that the man who made it up, Henry Spaulding, was one of the most fraudulent people he'd ever come across in his study of history. But that did not kill the story, simply because elite historians at Yale and other places said the story was not true. That didn't mean that people surrendered it, and particularly in the Pacific Northwest. It was clung to for another 60 years. I grew up in eastern Washington and went to elementary school and acted in a school play that told the story of Whitman's heroism. And this was in the 1960s, more than 60 years after the thing had been completely debunked, but it was still being taught to school children as real history. It was just too delicious. It was too self-affirming. It was too godly to surrender. And in some ways, this story sort of echoes what happened in the American South throughout the 20th century. Small Southern towns kept putting up statues of Southern generals, and it helped them to explain the Civil War as a noble defense of states' rights rather than a greed-driven desire to continue slavery of human beings. And in the same respect, the Whitman story, which is noble missionaries defending American values against a British Indian Catholic plot, is sort of the same kettle of fish, and the story was clung to for many decades.
About a year and a half, maybe even 2 years ago, I talked to Doug Swanson, who wrote Cult of Glory. It was the story of the Texas Rangers. He debunked some myths regarding the Texas Rangers, and so I thought about that book as I was reading your book, and his book resulted in some statues coming down. Your book's having the same effect. Where do you fall on that whole idea of removing statues?
Well, the statue of Whitman as a representative of the finest in achievement by a resident of Washington State simply is not appropriate. I mean, he was a mediocre guy who turned his back on the Cayuse Indians that he had come west to convert. And by the way, he was there 11 years and managed to convert two people. So he wasn't very good at his job, and he actually lost interest in it. And the state legislature, just in the past 3 weeks, has decided that they need to replace him with somebody who was more important. And so they have. They've replaced him with a Native American named Billy Franks Jr., who kept getting arrested as he tried to enforce federal law about fishing rights and environmental law. And he was kind of he was brave. He was consistent. He was principled. And now his statue is going to be in the Hall of Statuary in the Capitol, replacing Marcus Whitman. But I think it'll happen by the end of the summer.
Well, and what I love about this book is that it was nothing you set out to write, but nonetheless stumbled onto it, and that's how all great nonfiction comes, right?
Well, one thing that I did not know when I started work on the book is the long misery of the Cayuse tribe, but also the book has, you know, it really does have an affirming ending, and it helps. It actually affirms American principles. In the 1850s, when the Cayuse were sent to a reservation, they signed a treaty that guaranteed them protection on their land in perpetuity. And it took a long time, but finally, in the 1960s, federal judges in the Pacific Northwest and actually across America began to enforce the actual language in the treaties that the U.S. Senate had ratified. And slowly, the tribes developed a bureaucratic infrastructure, an administrative expertise that allowed them to use the courts and the law and good business practices to pull themselves together. And then finally, in the early 1990s, when Congress passed the National Gaming Law, the Cayuse could open a casino, and they drew pretty good crowds from Portland, Oregon, and from other parts of the Pacific Northwest, and they started to make some serious money, money that they completely controlled. And since then, they've reinvested the money, built other businesses, sent lots of kids to college, decreased their child mortality rate, improved virtually every demographic measurement of well-being, and they're well on their way to becoming an important economic and political power in Eastern Oregon. And they did it using the treaty and using U.S. law and using their own good discipline. And, it's a really great story, and I didn't know that that's how the book would end, but, that's the truth of what happened, and it makes for I think, a story that is not heartbreaking at the end.
It was an incredibly readable book, and I enjoyed it. The book is Murder at the Mission, A Frontier Killing, Its Legacy of Lies, and the Taking of the American West by Blaine Hardin. The book is available now. Blaine, fantastic addition to our American history studies here, and I thank you for joining us to talk about it.
It's a pleasure talking to you.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
It's Roll On, Columbia, roll on. Roll on.